see examples of what we talked about on the show, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. And Al said that if I screw this one up, that we're just going to use it anyway.
So yes, we're going to use a faulty show.
This is episode number 109.
Yes.
And I'm your host, Dallas Busha, and along with me we have...
Al.
And Donna.
Yeah, all right, we got it. That was better than the first 27 takes.
Yes.
So hello, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. And happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa.
Feliz Navidad.
Feliz Navidad. Happy Chinookah.
And
Hanukkah.
And whatever else you celebrate.
Anything else that you celebrate, happy holidays. It is the season. We'll probably have one more episode for this before Christmas, but either
winter
way.
Winter Solstice, isn't that one of the...
Happy Winter Solstice. Yes. I'm sure there's something in Skyrim, too, a winter holiday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, I want to welcome everybody, and Don and Al, welcome, guys. Thanks for holding the fort while I was gone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Not thank you for being gone or anything like that.
No, I was thanking it for being gone.
Okay.
I thought so.
So what are we doing on this show?
Well, I'm running really slow because I'm trying to upload some images. This is our first multimedia effort. And what I mean by that is we have a specific topic today. The topic is the Masters of Graphic Design. And basically what it's going to be is a bunch of images, examples of what we feel are some of the titans, the giants of the comic book medium that excel in their art and their graphic design, and they really push the medium.
Hmm.
Now, we're going to have a list, and I want to start by saying it's not in any specific order, and also I'm sure everyone's going to have a different list. So these just happen to be our opinions, and if we left anyone out, it wasn't on purpose. We're sorry. But what we're going to do is go through this list that we devised of the Masters of Graphic Design and kind of just talk a little bit about why we think they're the masters or why they've had such a huge influence on the medium. And we have visual examples, an image, a full-page image per master. And what we're going to do is post that up on our blog. So if you're listening to the show, go ahead and go to our blog, which is at...
Bunchofdorks.com. And then click on the Cyclops.
And then pull up this episode, 109, and then all of the images should be in the order that we're talking about.
And we're on iTunes also.
We're also on iTunes, yeah. So if you, but I don't know how the images are going to be up on there.
Oh, that's right. The images will not show up on iTunes. Facebook page will have them too, right? Facebook
Maybe page? We shouldn't have so many beers before we do the show.
The show does.
Go to our blog, bunchofdorks.com, click on the Cyclops, go to episode 109, and you'll see all the images that we're talking about. That way you can kind of follow along, and you know, when we're pointing out certain panels or certain things that's going on in the picture, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. And as usual, we always support feedback. You know, we really want to hear it and we encourage it. So go ahead and leave, you know, some notes or just any kind of comments on our blog or our Facebook page, and you know, join in the dialogue. It'd be a lot of fun.
And on the Facebook page, if you like, you could post your own thoughts on masters and images under the comments, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Because like I said earlier, this is our opinion, and it's going to be different for everybody. So we want to hear what you guys think and what you feel and who you think we left out and why we're a bunch of jerks, because we did. So first off, just for good radio, Don, what folder is it that I'm looking for?
Yeah, this is why I was wanting to do this off the mic.
First off, we're going to have how many Masters of Graphic Design?
Masters of the Universe we've got.
Yeah, Masters of the Universe.
We've got about 20. So
Skeletor and...
There's upwards of 20 guys on here. So, I mean, this is going to be a fat-loaded episode. And we're going to have a lot of fun.
Well, in order to be a comic book artist, you really should be a master of design anyway, because a lot of...
And master of your own domain.
Yeah, yeah. Because a lot of comic book, you know, page layout is design-based, you know, as opposed to, like, even though a lot of it is storytelling, you know, there is a give and take, there is a, you know, way of design of doing the page, so it's pleasing to the eye, not just, like, you know, one panel to another panel to another panel. So, but these are the big boys. These are the guys that seem to have the facility with
yes,
you know,
that's a good word as well, yeah. Too, because they're able to take everything and put it all together to make an incredible package for the comic book medium. You know, they're good designers, they're good artists, and they understand and know how to elaborate on the language of comics themselves.
You know, I don't know if it was Toth or one or maybe a few other artists, but I've heard stories where like some guys, maybe Toth probably, maybe some others, would just take a blank page and just do a abstract design on it, like in black, and then design the page around that whole that design. You know, like say the black is like, you know, rectangular or vertical or big here, small here, and then that's where the blocks would be spotted, and they would draw the page around that, which is pretty
about?
Interesting. I think Toth was would do that, or some artists would do that.
One thing on this. Design was something I never thought about as a kid. You know, I like comics, I like the drawing, and most of the time, whenever I drew, it's like most of us, you make pinups. You know, you're just drawing the character over and over. You weren't making comic books or anything like that.
Right.
And when I was in college, my friend Britt was a fellow art student wanting to become a cartoonist. And, you know, they're always going on composition all the time in school. And he was explaining about people don't understand that even though it's a sequential panels, what you have to work on is a composition for the entire page.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was something I never thought about. But I started realizing a lot of things that I always liked, I attributed to art, was actually design. You know, sometimes some books would have a separate designer than the artist. Sometimes the artist would design it, sometimes, you know, they just do the illustrations and somebody else set up the design. And album covers, magazines, you know, books, I always found that the design was the element that I really enjoyed the most. There are some artists that are just fantastic designers, and they put that in their work, which is what we're going to be talking about today.
Right. Well, then, without further ado, let's get started. Up first, we have the late, great Alex Toth.
Well, yeah, there's a perfect example of, like, designing an entire page. The lettering, the logo, the imagery, it's all there. It's a splash page from Batman. I forgot what issue it was, but it's a Death Flies the Haunted Sky. We'll give it to you on the blog post or whatever.
Yeah, you can see it on there. Now, a little background for people that don't know who Alex Toth is, because hopefully this podcast will actually shed a little light on some of these greats that people may never heard of or had always been interested in and never checked them out. So Toth is from
a Golden Age artist.
Yes,
he was around in the 40s, and he started, like a lot of these guys, real young. And you know, in the 40s, he kind of had a Milton Caniff style, which a lot of guys did, because that was a big cartoonist at the time. By the 50s, a lot of them kind of like grew into themselves as an artist. And Toth became almost like engrossed in design. I mean, to me, his work is almost design. It's almost like abstract in a way, because there's some artists, like say, like even though they're great designers, like a Williamson or Frazetta or people like that, that are really into the rendering. You know, they're really into the figurative work and all that. Even though they do design beautifully, Toth almost takes it to the simplicity of everything, which is, I guess, is what design's all about.
You're absolutely right.
And then he just creates like an entire page, which is like all of it. It's not like the logo was drawn by, you know, a letter or anything. That's the whole deal. You know, everything flows together. Everything is clear, which is really important. You see Batman. You see he's on a water tower, you see the plane coming at him, you see the buildings in the background. It's cluttered, but the way he lays it out, it's perfect in a way.
It's when you say cluttered, there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on.
Look at this image. Batman
it's
himself
clear.
Is
everything's
very
clear.
Everything's clear. Batman's very clean.
Yeah.
Like you were saying about Alex Toth's kind of less is more aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And it's what I'm surprised about, and I've seen a lot of Toth's work, but what I really love about this image is how dynamic it is.
Yep.
When you open, this is the first page of a comic, I'm assuming it looks like it.
Yeah, Splash. Yeah.
It says number one in the bottom corner.
Yeah.
It jumps at you. You pull that cover back, and boom, you are in the middle of the story. You've got Batman, his cape's literally flowing into the foreground in your face. It's got the title of the book, which... or the title of the comic, Death Flies the Haunted Sky, which really stands out with a big skull and the A. So, I mean, you can't miss that. And then it just says Batman incorporated so well. Very
into the cow.
Will Eisner-ish, and we'll get into him later, yeah. I'm sure. How, the words Batman are inside of the cowl, and it's almost part of the art. And if you squint, you don't even know it says Batman. It just looks like, you know, a lighting on the back of his cape.
Yeah, well, you have to simplify the Batman character because there's so much else going on. You know, he's almost like an outline in a way, you know, because there's so much going on that you wouldn't be able to see him. And then even on the bottom of the wire tower, when he's got all the darks, he actually put the bottom of Batman's boot in like white, so you could actually tell that's his foot. Because if
Oh,
he
you're
wouldn't have
right.
done that, you wouldn't have. Another artist may actually go and draw like the bottom of the foot and give it like a, you know, like a shape or like some shadow or whatever. But a guy who's like really into design is going to just take it out because he's going to go, well, you can't read it. Even in the rope, even in, I think it's a rope. See how it's dark around where the water
It's
towers,
wrapping around him.
and then it turns white. Maybe that's not the way it would in a real illustration, but for the sake of a picture, yeah,
Yeah, you're right.
He was really good at working with negative space.
Yes.
Of all people, he always used it to his own effect. I mean, and that's the thing, right? As soon as you see that picture, like Dallas said, you're right in the middle of the action. It's a pretty complex, but it's deceptively simple.
It's deceptively
You don't
simple,
have
yeah.
to think about it. It's immediately you see it, and you see what's happening.
And then the thing about doing simple work is that you got to be really good because you can hide a lot of like imperfections by being very
Detailed.
detailed and
You're
you
right.
know. When you do simplistic work like that, or somebody like Roy Crane or somebody like
Or
that,
the Hernandez
those
brothers.
Hernandez brothers, man, that figure's got to be like
It's
really, really perfect, or else
and
it's going to be really obvious that it's not a well-drawn picture.
also I just wanted to add that it's a testament to Toth's artwork that Batman is such a standout. You can't even see his head. You can't see the
Right.
signature ears, but you know exactly who it is,
Yeah,
you know.
you see it all there.
So,
I remember reading a story about Toth when he when Kirby moved to California. Toth actually looked him up because he just wanted to, you know, get together and they wanted to have like a meeting and, you know, like say, hey, you know, how do you draw? Like, you know, tricks, learn things or whatever. What they both learned from each other was that they were both completely different artists and neither one of them had an idea how they did what they did. So it was just kind of like, oh,
That's
well,
awesome. I never knew that.
I read it in a long interview with Toth. He said he tried to like see if he can learn something from Kirby or get something or whatever. Because like Kirby was just like a completely different kind of artist. He would just, Kirby, I think, could just start by drawing a finger and then that would lead into like the rest of the figure. He wasn't like, he was, a, what I read, he wasn't like a guy who outlines the whole figure or anything like that, even though maybe later on he did. But Toth is totally like, wow, why did he do this, you know? And I guess Toth maybe did the same thing to Kirby, so they both kind of like, well, it's nice to meet you, but, you know, we didn't really didn't
So
learn anything
I
from each
know
other.
Toth always roughed out shapes real quick. You know, I
Yeah,
mean,
most
a couple
artists do.
circles and ovals
But you
here.
know, and I know Jack Kirby, I've always read that he just put the line to paper.
Yeah.
And like Mobius the same way. And
Yeah.
I never got to see Jack Kirby draw a video, but I've seen Mobius a lot on the internet if you look him up. And it's the strangest thing because I've seen him do underdrawing, but a lot of times I see him just drawing straight to paper. And it's almost like he's tracing on a light box, like how a person would have a drawing underneath that's tracing it. But he was tracing nothing. He was drawing right on paper, and he was drawing from his head. He could trace what he saw in his head.
It's like something that some artists have. I guess somebody told me it's like a memory, like an artistic memory that once they look at something and they draw it, they'll never forget it. So if you draw that one figure once, some people have this, they'll never forget it, and they can just do it again out of their brain. They don't have to do an underdrawing. But if they draw a car once, they know how to draw it, so they figured it out. I don't have that
Me
ability,
neither.
you know.
Me
A
neither.
lot, most artists use rough photo reference anyway, but there's some like Mobius, and I think I read one time, I read Kaluta said that too, that he's got this memory where he just looks at something, and if he sees it, he knows how to draw it again. There's no
He's
point
got
of
the idea,
reference.
spatial awareness. He knows where things are in comparison to everything else and how it's going to look.
Yeah,
It's.
and I one time I read another interview with Wrighton where it says that, I mean, maybe he did do underdrawing because I know he does layouts, but he's got it in his brain. He goes, my brain is like you know, a scan, not a scanner, but a tracing machine. It's in my brain, and my hand knows exactly what to do. You know, I'm like,
That's
it's pretty
incredible.
amazing. You know, but anyway, yeah, Toth is, you know, my pick
Okay,
for
so that's it. That's number one.
that's number one.
So, moving along, next we have Art Spiegelman.
Yeah,
Now,
okay.
Art Spiegelman was from he began in underground comics. Really, he rose to prominence in the 60s with the underground comics movement, COMIX, and he was getting pretty big, probably around the same time as Art Crumb, or maybe a few years afterwards. And Spiegelman was great because he was in a pop art, and he was highly
He was,
experimental.
yeah.
He was a highly experimental artist, and it really shows in a lot of his work. And the piece I chose today, or one of us did, I don't remember who chose it. Can you see it from there,
Yeah, I
Alex?
can see it.
It's one that was I don't know. It was published in probably one of his anthologies, But it's basically nothing more than a one-page story of a guy sitting inside of his house in different panel layouts and different perspectives from the house, and just he's sitting there on a chair watching television, and just the way that that Spiegelman plays around with the shapes, the shading, the colors, it's all black and white, is just really impressive. I've always liked this piece. I found it in a big collection that Don got me.
Is it from Raw Magazine?
It's probably from Raw Magazine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's best known for Mouse.
Yeah. Which is funny because I would say aesthetically that's probably his least experimental work. And not saying it's not good by
subject
any
matter.
Demand.
Subject matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Strong
the subject matter is gross. So I'm not saying it's that's apples and oranges, but it seems like the majority of his work, especially a lot of his early work, was highly experimental. He was an avant-garde artist, and to be able to bring that sensibility to the comic book medium was something not completely new at the time, but it was fairly low-key.
It was different. It was definitely different in the 70s. That's when all that stuff started happening.
Whenever I think of his work, though, he always uses really harsh shapes, really harsh lines, and he always makes it kind of awkward. Like, you're looking at this page right here. He's got the standard, straight panel layout, but the images inside it, they may even be, lining up with it, but they're always kind of awkward angles to it. And he uses a lot of blacks, but...
It's abstract. It's very
busy,
abstract.
And very busy.
You're right, it's busy, and like Al said, abstract is kind of what you're saying too, Don, is it's a square, he's got square, perfect panels, but inside of those panels, everything is at a diagonal proportion, everything's slightly off.
Well, he gives it a chaotic energy to it. And he does play around with everything else. Mars, like you said, is kind of straightforward. He did work with a different style. It was kind of a sketchy, softer style, but I loved it just as much. His compositions are always strong. And he's continued to play around with everything.
And this page is a good example. It's not a traditional continuity on the page from first panel to last. He's actually playing around with images, panel by panel, and sometimes taking those images, you see him from a different angle, or you see him slightly skewed. It reminds me of some of Andy Warhol's more famous stuff.
Yeah.
Well, in another sense, whereas some of the other artists, not all of them, some are artists that were influenced by maybe other cartoonists or whatever, he is in a sense, but he's also influenced from a lot of fine art stuff, which gives it a different feel to it.
You're right. He has a different background, I think.
Yeah, he's not like Toth, who came from Kniff or anybody like that. He comes from a different viewpoint, even though he's probably like influenced by those people, and that gives it like a different feel to it, which is more adult, I guess, and more whatever you want, what word you want to use. So it's a different kind of page.
Some people would call it art, in quotes.
Quotes, yeah, exactly, yeah. But it's all art anyway.
That's Art Spiegelman, and most people, like Al mentioned, will know him from his work on Mouse.
And Raw
it's
Magazine.
So huge. But and Raw Magazine also. But, I mean, he's had so much work come out. A lot of it in anthologies. He did a great book called In the Shadow of No Towers after 9/11 occurred. And he's just got a lot of great work out there that I think people should be exposed to, other than Mouse.
Yep.
Just because his body of work is so big and so varied.
Yeah,
definitely. So it's definitely worth checking him out if you're into high art, air quotes. Okay, you guys ready to go on next?
Let's go.
Next up, we have Bill Sienkiewicz. This was pretty difficult to decide, well, first to spell his last name, but also to decide what piece of work to use of his. I went with his kind of, not early work, his very early work was very Neil Adams inspired, to say kind of dynamic superhero action. But after that, he did his great run on New Mutants in the 1980s, probably early 80s, where he really started to experiment with panel layouts, with coloring, with a lot of his work is painted. So colors and using the colors to convey dramatic images and pacing. And so I found some of his stuff. I don't even know where the heck I got this image, to tell you the truth, anymore. But as you can see, it's clearly, especially for, I think it was the late 80s that this came out, it was pretty wild for its time. And it still is, to an extent, especially for a traditional mainstream comic book sensibility. It's a lot different. And like I said, he's a painter. He also does some mixed media stuff sometimes. And I don't know. I mean, I think the image kind of speaks for itself. It's the way it's paced, it can be a little confusing, but in the context of the book, it works.
Well, Don, your favorite is Electra Assassin.
Yeah, well, Bill Sienkiewicz, like I said, when he was doing Moon Knight, I don't know what else he did besides Moon Knight in the early days, but he was always referred to as, he draws like Neil Adams, but with a sketchier finish. And people always bagged on him. I heard John Byrne one time says that Neil Adams learned to draw by looking at people. Bill Sienkiewicz learned by drawing from Neil Adams. And, you know, people thought it was funny, but everybody was trying to draw like Neil Adams. John Byrne was trying to draw. They all failed miserably. They never looked like Neil. Bill Sienkiewicz was the only one that could do it. And when Doug Monk, or Monk, however you say his name, left
Munch,
Marvel,
Munch.
Munch, when he left Marvel, Bill Sienkiewicz left Moon Knight as well. He went freelance, and he started doing painted covers for Marvel. Now, I think there was a What If cover. It says, What if Captain America was never frozen in ice?
Yeah.
And it was staggering. It was Bill Sienkiewicz. You knew it was him, but it was a different style. I saw a lot of Ralph Steadman in it. You said you saw a lot of Bob Peak. I guess he was a mix, but...
He started getting into the magazine and illustrators like those guys.
Yeah, you said he's always looking for old TV guys all the
time.
Oh,
here's a story. Back in the early 80s, there was a little mini convention in Miami. He was the guest. And I was there talking to him or watching him or whatever. And then, like, he had, like, he got from some guy, like, a box full of old TV guides. And he was just ripping the covers off them because they were, like, either Bob Peak or, you know, whatever the illustrators were. And that's where he was getting his, you know, his inspiration for him. Because back then, those guys didn't have books done on them. So that's what he was doing. And I was like, oh, my God.
There was no internets.
Yeah, there were no internets. But, well, were there? I don't know. Not for us, anyway. But
no.
I wish I could have had the guts to him, you know, because he had all Miami TV listings. But oh well, you know. But that's where he was taking his inspiration from. But as Moon Knight kept going, his art style, if you look at him, like the later ones, it started getting weirder and weirder. So you can tell that he was kind of like getting influenced as it went by. I think one of the last few that he did, his art had changed completely from the first one.
Yeah.
He still had a Neil Adams illustrative, you know, shadow or look to it. But it got real abstract. So
well,
that was happening.
His camera angles were changing on Moon Knight too.
Layouts were changing.
Yeah, he's starting to get a little more dynamic.
Yeah.
But after he started doing those covers, I thought, wow, he completely broke that mold. And then when he started doing New Mutants, that was a shock because New Mutants was kind of to me a pedestrian comic book. You
it's
know,
kind of X-Men light.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it was. And he came on, and I thought, really, and boy. He busted on that book. It's like it was all him, all over the pages.
Yeah, the bear storyline.
Yeah. The demon bear saga.
Yeah. And then he went off and he came back as an inker for a while too to give it that look. Like I remember him inking Mary Wilshire and some issues later on, and then he was gone, you know, for good from the book. But yeah, he did a lot of work for New Mutants. Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed that book, and it was almost like getting to see I like looking at sketchbooks. And I felt like I was in his place, you know, in his house, looking through personal sketchbooks, the way he was drawing that book. And I remember when he was leaving, somebody on the ship said, nobody's ever going to be able to do Warlock like him, you know, that character that they created. And I mean, I've seen Alan Davis and other people draw it, and I liked it. But yeah, nobody could do Warlock the way Bill Sienkiewicz.
Absolutely.
Was Ralph Steadman the guy that got famous for working with Hunter Thompson? Is that what his big thing was?
I couldn't tell you. I've read about Ralph Steadman in a comic journal. I think he was interviewed.
Okay.
And I've seen his drawings. I mean, it's one of those things where I remember seeing the drawings all the time in old magazines and stuff. But I couldn't tell you one thing.
Because I keep thinking, but I just figured it out, that Ralph Steadman, I thought, was the guy who did the drawings for the wall, but that was another guy. That was
I always
Gerald
thought
Scarfe.
That too. Yeah.
Gerald Scarfe was the guy who did the wall stuff. It wasn't Steadman, but it reminds me of Ralph Steadman.
Yeah.
I just said that so I could drop names and seem like I know that. You know, but, you know, whatever.
But no, when he started doing work like with Frank Miller, he did that Electro Assassin.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite work he's done, especially that first issue.
Yeah, that's probably the first time I saw Sienkiewicz was when he did Electra and Assassin.
Oh, it was incredible.
That's huge.
And just the timing of how it went, because it was telling her story as Electra, and then it was telling her story as, you know, when her mom and dad met when they were pregnant. And the pages just kept zipping through, and then they kept showing her growing up like in an orphanage. And it reminded me of what was that old French storybook, Madeleine?
Yeah.
And excuse me. But the rhythm of it was just constantly changing. And I thought, man, how in the world are you going to ever pass this up? The rest of the series was good. It was 8 issues. My favorite work. But that first issue, it was just something. It was like catching a lightning bug in your hand. It was just something special. He went on, did a Daredevil graphic novel with Frank Miller.
A lot of stuff.
And he did a 4-issue series called Stray Toasters, which to me, he wrote it as well. That's the most Bill Sienkiewicz book I've ever read in my life.
Extremely experimental.
Yeah. Big numbers.
Big numbers with Alan Moore, which is an unfinished project. Mm. But I think they had, what, 2 issues done?
Yeah,
written
they did
by
too.
Moore, drawn by Sienkiewicz?
Yep.
Yeah, they. I heard there was a third one, but I don't know if the third one ever came out. I guess Bill Sienkiewicz's assistant, I'm told, finished it, but I may be wrong. But those, you know, you always talk about you wish a series would have gone on. I always had two. One was when First Comics was doing Lone Wolf and Cub, and they went bankrupt. I guess they did 45 issues. And I was always wishing they'd finish it. Well, that came true because Dark Horse took it over and did all the issues, and it was great. But the other one was Big Numbers. I was really enjoying that. It started out, you know, it's painted. It was about some girl in England. But the colors were real muted. They were grays and some browns. And then what I'm told was as the series progressed, it started having more colors and stuff introduced into it. But it was really strong work. The story really captivated me. They were square issues. And I thought, man, these are something. And then it just stopped. And I never really quite got the story on it. I think Eddie Campbell wrote some book about what not to do as a cartoonist, and it was a slam of Bill. And he was on a podcast called Fanboy Radio, and they both asked him about it. And he was very congenial. He says, well, he says, you know, there's some times in your life where you just do something you wish you hadn't. And that's all he said. It wasn't embarrassing or anything. He just basically said, I know when Electra Assassin came up, I was reading about it in Amazing Heroes or a comics interview. I'm not sure. But he said, you know, him and Frank agreed to do this story and, you know, they signed the papers. And he talked to Frank about it. He says, after he got the script, he said, he just freaked out for a minute. And he says, he got overwhelmed and he walked out of the studio and walked around the block, you know, in the neighborhood like, what have I gotten myself into? How am I going to get this done? Well, when I'm reading this, I just read the first issue, and I'm thinking, how can you even think that? I mean, he pulled it off in spades. It was the most incredible thing I'd ever read. But you're still a human being. So I guess he really approaches each project as he gives it everything he's got and more than what he's got.
Which is the mark of a true artist, though. He's putting his heart and soul into it.
So I don't really know the whole story between him and Big Numbers, but I wish it would have been finished.
Maybe one day.
One thing I wanted to say, we're starting to do this already, but I forgot to mention in the beginning, is I wanted to have a list after each artist and the page we talk about. We're going to give you guys kind of a little catalog of some of their best work or some of their more famous work. Now, we did that with Sienkiewicz just now. We did that with Spiegelman. We didn't really talk much about Alex Toth's work. He was very popular for doing The Mask of Zorro.
Oh, he did. He did like everything. He was a freelancer basically. Mm-hmm. You know, he did a lot of different books. He's probably best known for the Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah, he did a lot of Hanna-Barbera work. Space
like
Ghost.
That. Yeah, he had layouts for all that. But in comics, he was a freelancer. He did mostly DC and Bell, and a little bit of Marvel, not much, not a whole. Not
so
a whole
just
lot.
Wikipedia him or Google him up.
Well, in the Golden Age, he did some of the Golden Age Green Lantern stories. He also did Johnny Thunder for All-Star Western, which were nice.
There you go.
Ton of stuff.
He did a lot of work for Dell, the Zorro work.
Yeah.
Which you can get all this stuff collected now. And like Al said, those Hanna-Barbera cartoons of the 60s. But the best thing, if you want to see Alex Toth's work, is get the Genius books that I can't think of who put those out.
God, I don't remember.
We talked about them on
we'll
an earlier
them on
episode.
The book. We'll put them on the blog, you know.
We'll put them on the
will
blog.
Will we?
Yes, you will.
If he remembers.
We'll
okay.
send it to you.
So moving along. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break, a music break, and then we'll jump back and do some more.
can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
And that was Samaria. They're based in Manila in the Philippines. We got a link to them. If you want to go see them, please do. And I think they're also available to hire.
Yeah. In the Philippines.
Well, yeah.
All over the world.
Boy, I tell you what, if I could, I'd bring them in. I do like them. It's a tight band, and they're very interesting.
They play all over?
I think in the Manila area.
Okay.
Al just gave us some of the best chocolate chip cookies in the world.
You want more?
And then he wouldn't. And then he wouldn't let us record because our mouths were full.
Yeah. Okay, who's next?
Moving along, we have the great Bill Watterson, comic strip artist, who did a daily and Sunday comic strips, most notably famous for Calvin and Hobbes from the mid-80s up to, what, the early 90s, I think?
95.
Yeah.
There you go. Now look at you.
85 to 95.
So the example I put up, ironically enough, I think this is the very last one.
Yeah.
If I want to say that right. But the reason I like this one so much, it shows Bill Watterson's design. It might not be his best work per se, or his most colorful, or his most dramatic, but as far as pacing and minimalism, I mean, he flipping nails it. There's a lot of open, empty white space, and it's signified by snow, but it constantly shows motion and moving forward. You see the characters in the first panel. You know, you can see they're coming from off panel, and then you have a good, fairly decent close-up of them, you know, moving around, and then that last panel, they're just kind of going off into the unknown, away from the panel, like they're moving forward from the first panel to the last panel, and it's just fantastic. It's very well paced, and it's just a treat to look at, despite having so much negative space.
One thing about that, when he worked with a lot of white space, like it was just nice to see a little spots of color he used for the characters. It was simple, but he could be minimalist. He could always add things. Like in spring, it was always busy. He had all the leaves and stuff. But he was a one-man band. He wrote the strip. He drew the strip. Did all the lettering. And it always had a fantastic design. Even the four-panel daily strip, you know, mm-hmm. small and black and white. But just how he placed his characters, how he put it in. And he could draw. I mean, besides design work, he was just a fantastic illustrator.
You're right, and you were saying sometimes his stuff can be busy, but intentionally. Like when he would do the Spaceman Spiff sequences, yeah. I mean, he was doing these incredibly detailed aliens and dinosaurs, and you're right, the guy can draw like a mother. He was really good.
Man, that's really nice work. Very simple,
mm-hmm. yeah,
but to the point.
It was to the point that, he, you know, going besides the design work, the stories and the strip, they were funny. But he always had something to say that made you think. You know, mm-hmm. it had a lot of philosophy to it. I really missed that strip.
Mm-hmm.
He did it for 10 years, and then finally he just retired. And he said he didn't want the strip to go on further and start showing stretch marks and, you know, where you grew to head.
Stretch marks.
And I was really happy. The newspaper changed when he left the newspaper.
I'm sure, you know, pretty much everyone listening has heard of Calvin and Hobbes, but if you're not really intimate with the strip, or if you never really grew up reading it, I mean, just pick up some of the collected editions. You'll see why he is still considered the giant of modern comic strips.
And the collections are available for not a bad price.
No, you can get them really, you know, in pretty much any bookstore. Most major comic book shops sell them also, and you can find them online, I'm sure.
So he was against merchandise, but not reprints of the strip. He was against, like, T-shirts and cups. And
right. Reprints, that was still the original pieces, the original art. But when it came to merchandising, you're right, like cups or a T-shirt.
Like to become a Garfield or something.
Well, that was it. When Universal took him, they were looking. I don't think it was Universal. It was another one. They paid for him, I guess, for a year to help him develop the strip, and he was on their payroll. And he said they were looking at Hobbes, the tiger character, to be a merchandising thing. And then after he developed the strip, they decided they didn't want it. They let him go. So he went to Universal with everything, and they took it and published it. And he says it was always odd. I don't know what that other syndicate was. But he did it, and then as the strip went on, they were talking about merchandising it. And he decided, his comment was he didn't want a stuffed animal company to answer the question for everybody, is Hobbes really a stuffed animal or is he a real tiger? And he was talking about it kind of takes away the strip. He also said a lot of cartoonists see the merchandising as, a gold mine, just extra money. To try to explain the difference between how much the strip pays and how much merchandising pays, I was reading in the early 80s, they were talking about Peanuts. The Peanuts was probably the biggest newspaper strip we've ever seen. It had a huge circulation. And they said the comic strip itself generated $1 million a year, which is pretty good. The merchandising was $240 million a year. So you understand the difference.
That shows that Bill Watterson's a true artist because he stuck to his guns and he was doing it. He was creating art for art's sake.
Well, and Bill Watterson was a huge Peanuts fan. And he said, Charles Schulz had a lot to say. His philosophy, he brought up points. But he said part of it, I think, the guy doing the interview brought up how a lot of people see Peanuts now as kind of trite, And he says, well, I it's not. He says, I think what the problem is there's so many Hallmark cards and Avon products and bread wrappers and posters and, you name it. Peanuts has been made into everything and is on everything.
You're right.
And he says it takes away from the integrity of the strip somewhat. And so that's why he didn't, and that's one reason he retired, was when he was fighting with the syndicate, he was afraid at one point that they were just going to bring in another cartoonist to do the strip and take the strip away from him. And I remember Universal came into the papers and saying, listen, we're being very benevolent to him. We actually own the strip, which is true. Finally, he got the strip back, and that's when they changed things where he could make the Sunday paper bigger, and he had control. They couldn't take out any, the way the newspaper comics on Sunday works is they have two throwaway panels at the top, and then the rest of it's the thing, because some newspapers cut those out and reposition the strip for size, and Peanuts had that, a lot of places had it. Well, he set it up to where it had to be, I guess, the whole top half of the paper.
Yeah, I remember growing up as a young kid reading those.
And then some papers complained they didn't want to do that, so the syndicate allowed a smaller size where they could run another strip on the side of it. But anyway, he retired it, but that strip still, you look at old Golden Age strips, some of them are just so beautifully drawn. And when I was growing up, I'd see the strips in the paper, in the 70s and early 80s. And God, I wish we could have something like that. And then Calvin Hobbes came out. To me, it stands up to some of the old Golden Age strips that we used to see. It was nothing like it,
See, the thing about merchandising is I understand what he's talking about, but whenever people say that, I always kind of whiffle. What about the Beatles? They were able to merchandise the hell out of themselves,
and
they still have artistic integrity, but it's a little bit different. But it's pretty cheesy what they did in the early days, but they basically, the Beatles went from cheesy merchandising to more artistic integrity as it went along. But yeah, that's the opposite side of that coin. But yeah, I could see that becoming Garfield, and I'm sure that's not even why.
Well, another thing is...
Oh, it's funny. Jim Davis is next. No, I'm just kidding.
Nice.
No, not really.
Ernie Bushmiller in there anywhere? Not that it was merchandise.
But but I guess that's the thing. When you start getting merchandise, next thing you know, the sponsors always come in and say, well, you can't see this, you can't do that, because that's... A friend of mine was a DJ on a radio station. He needed me to come in one time. And when I was talking to him, all of a sudden, these people kept sticking in, so-and-so's upset because the ad didn't run correctly. And, it was constantly. I was only there for like 20 minutes. And about 800 times, somebody else in the radio station came in, all right, we're going to have to find another segment because, Hillside Construction was upset that, 3 seconds of their ad was cut off.
Yeah.
And, then somebody said, all right, you're running this ad, don't do that joke you're going to do earlier about, whatever, And I think that's one other reason. Nevertheless, Bill Watterson did love the collections of the strip because it was a chance for the strips that people could read them. He liked the fact that people cut out comic strips and put them on the refrigerator or workspace. Yeah, well, we
I
all
did
do
that.
That. And so he liked that, but he's a huge book fan, but he didn't like, when I say this, I do kind of like this stuff. I would have liked to have gotten a Calvin Hobbes figurine or a stuffed animal.
Lunchbox.
As a matter of fact, my daughter made me a Hobbes stuffed animal.
Pretty cool.
But he's okay with that stuff. He says it's something somebody made, that's fine, as long as they're not making money off of it. But he said he just didn't want the question to be answered over the relationship between that that, you know, was Hobbs really a real tiger or a stuffed tiger? And he didn't like the fact that the character would go on a coffee, you know, mug or something like that, and it's like, or a drinking glass at Burger King. And it's like, it's not really part of a comic strip anymore that people read for enjoyment. It's just a product, you know, so.
Yeah, I can see it. I do like that he stuck to his guns.
All right.
So next up, we've got Chris Ware.
Wow.
So this is kind of fun looking for an image by Chris Ware that I don't even know which book this one was out of. Maybe Jimmy Corrigan? Oh, probably his Acme Novelty Library. But Chris Ware, it comes from an incredible graphic design background. And he's much more of a graphic designer, I would say, than a comic book artist. I mean, he writes and draws comic books, but they're always based around his graphic design. And so his pacing, his sensibilities are, it comes from that background. So first and foremost, that's what he does. And you can completely tell from this two-page spread that I pulled up here, if you look at it. And I mean, everything's very intricate. And like some artists have done in the past, this piece is forcing you to think outside of the box, and you're moving the entire physical book in your hands 360 to complete reading the sequential story.
I mean, it's like a grid almost.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by the graphic design aspect is, look, it's drawn out. He obviously had this plan in advance. I mean, most artists do, but it's based upon a certain grid. But it's pretty interesting.
He's got a book out. I've never seen it in person. I've only seen it online. But I think it's called How to Build Stories. And it comes in a box. And it's got different sheets and stuff. But you can take that and build your own stories. It's kind of interesting. He's always put together that way.
Yeah.
The first thing I ever saw by him was Eclipse Comics put it out in 1986. It was called Floyd Farland, Citizen of the Future. And it was black and white, and it was kind of crudely drawn. And he used a lot of repetition. It was a lot of the same panel over and over. And it was about this... When I say this, it kind of reminds me of Brazil, where you had this guy with a mundane office job, except this guy was kind of playing with Clark Kent glasses. And some big espionage thing happened, and he was kind of caught up in it. And all through the book, they kept having this ad, says taxes. It's a damn good idea, you know. And it was all about government and this and that, and he was like a cog in the wheel that had no clue what was going on. I absolutely loved it. And I guess he just graduated from the University of Texas, and that was a comic strip he did for the paper there. Well, Eclipse hired one of these guys from the University of Texas to be an editor, and they said that he was so upset leaving the University of Texas and missing his favorite newspaper strip, so he hired Chris Ware to do it as a comic book.
That's awesome.
And Chris Ware said the problem was when you're doing a sequential, you know, strip in a weekly paper, it doesn't really work as a comic, so he had to redraw it. But, you know, and then later he was talking about he couldn't believe that somebody would actually want him to do a comic. You know, a friend of mine met him. He said he's really humble. But I found out later he's doing stuff for weekly papers, Quimby the Mouse and stuff like that. And it was nothing like the Floyd Farland style. And then the Acme Comic Library started coming out, or Novelty Library. And those are incredible. They're beautiful. And every time I'd buy one of these, the guy at the comic, oh, man, these are awesome. They are awesome, but either I'm missing the point, or his stories, they're nothing but depressing.
That's his view of the human condition, maybe?
Yeah,
And it just comes out, his emotions are generated through his art, and that's his subject material, and
yeah,
it's over and over, even in Quimby the Mouse, really.
He always shows that childhood is nothing but open perimeters and promise and bright horizons and everybody's special. And then when you're older...
Beat it out of you.
Well, you're just some...
Basically, yeah.
You know,
you beat down.
Some, yeah, well, it's not beating down. It's like there's just nothing to them. They're just washed up nobodies. And I heard Alan Moore one time, and he talked about Chris Ware, and he said he's a fantastic designer. He's a great cartoonist. He said, as far as the stories, the only thing he really says is, you're going to grow old and die. And I, well, yeah, it's... But nevertheless, I buy them anytime I see them. So the work is just... beautiful.
It's astounding, and yeah, it is beautiful just to sit back and look at, and just look at the amount of work that was put into this, and his design sensibilities are fantastic. Yeah, some of Chris Ware, we've already mentioned it, but some of Chris Ware's more popular stuff is earlier Quimby the Mouth stuff, Acme Novelty Library Collection, and Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth. It's probably some of that's his most popular, I think.
Is he related to Billy Corrigan?
He should be. All right, moving along. We've got Darwin Cook.
Ah, yes.
Darwin Qu
I couldn't
Cook.
tell that was him from here. Wow. Okay, is that from Parker or
Yes.
something? This is a great one. I like this piece because it's minimalistic in many ways as far as color. His art style is naturally, to an extent, minimalistic, and panel is borders. That's always very fun.
There should be a new school of comic book artists. The I don't know what the right way to call it, the Batman Adventures school,
Oh,
which is
yeah.
like Tim,
Bruce Timm.
Bruce Timm
him,
and
and Mike, what, Parabek, and oh, there's a few others that
Ty
Ty
Templeton worked that
Templeton. Yeah,
way.
they came from that school of illustration. That they're animators, or former, some of them anyway, and they have that nice kind of cartoony, simplistic. But that looks very 50s also with the
I always thought his style kind of lended itself to this, though, especially the Parker
yeah,
book. Now, I
definitely.
almost picked a different image than this. Did you? Wait, this is the one.
No, you chose it, and that's fine. I didn't choose the Darwin Cook
Oh,
image.
you didn't choose a Darwin Cook one? Okay, I couldn't remember who you did. I almost chose, there was another one, it must have been from a Batman book, Catwoman putting on her outfit.
Yeah.
And it was a series of small panels, and one is a close-up of her hand putting on a glove. One's putting on the mask and tying it in the back and what have you. And it was just paced really well, and it was just different angles. And just like this page that we're using as an example, it was all wordless. And it was great because it told such a great story.
Yeah, he's great.
And he's great sequential wise. He's great at pacing his pages. And just like you can look at this and tell exactly what's going on. I mean, there's no dialogue anyway, so you have to use the images. But he makes it Darwin Cook makes it seem so effortless.
He's pretty interesting because he worked for a fashion magazine in Canada for a long time, and he also worked for a music magazine. And he can draw. He was doing all this kind of work when he started watching the Batman animated series.
Oh, he got in, he thought he'd changed his style for the
No,
series. Oh.
that's something, I guess, not a sore spot, but something contention. He said he saw an ad in a trade magazine looking for cartoonists for that, and he was kind of shocked. He's quoted saying, "Who wouldn't want a job there?" He figured they'd had a surplus of cartoonists. So he moved to Los Angeles and got a job working for him. And that was something, a problem he had was he always drew that way. That was a style he already had. And
To fit in with those
yeah, he
guys.
fit in fine. And I mean, he wasn't just a cog. I know he had a lot, like the Batman Beyond, he did a lot of work for, and that whole opening sequence was Bruce Timm and Darwin Cook that did it. And he said when he left the series and was trying to get comic book work, DC immediately saw it and they wanted to do the Animated Adventures comic. And he said he didn't really want to be pigeonholed and being the
Oh, yeah,
animated guy.
exactly, yeah.
And so when he did the New Frontier,
Good move on his
oh no,
part.
what was enough? Batman Ego. It just sat in a pile of submissions. And finally, whoever was in charge of that was gone, and they put Mark Chiarello in charge. And Mark Chiarello was, going through the stuff that, it was like a whole office of piles. And he ran across Ego and said, "What is this?" And then he contacted Darwin Cook, but it sat there for, if I understand, a few years. And then, so he put that out, and then after that, everything came, the New Frontier and everything else. What I like about Darwin Cook is, like Dallas said this, or you said, it looks 50s, the
Yeah,
Parker.
it looks 50s,
I think the Parker work was written in the 50s.
It was.
And
It
those
was.
stories would not work now. Like some of these, Parker was basically a bank robber. And in one of these books, Darwin Cook adapted four of them, and they were all four fantastic. I think it was the second one. They robbed a mining town, and it was like inside a canyon. They figured if they just did this and this and cut off the telephone wires and did it on a certain payday, they could steal the whole payroll out of the mining town. Well, it worked. If you try to do that now, everybody's got a cell phone, And so they kept it in the 50s and it worked. New Frontier was basically about the birth of the Justice League, and it was all done in the late 50s and early 60s, and he's able to keep the style for each piece. It doesn't matter if it's simple or busy, he has a sense of design in everything. And Comic Book Artist magazine had a big write-up about him, and all the artwork in that magazine had nothing to do with the New Frontier. He had magazine covers of Hal Jordan, like a pilot. Excuse me. Sorry. But he was a pilot in the magazine. It looked like a real magazine. All through that, he had design pieces. His DC solo book, he had cigarette match covers and stuff with Zatanna on it and stuff. All through it, design just a prominent part of his work.
Good stuff. Great stuff.
All right. Yeah, and some of his bigger, more popular pieces of work are Parker. You mentioned New Frontier. Yeah. His work on the Batman Beyond animated series.
Yeah, well, he's also got that Catwoman 4-issue series when you get in a trade. He's also got a trade called Stealing His Big Score, which is, again, his Catwoman, but she's not dressed as Catwoman, and I think.
Cool.
And he's got a lot of single issues here and there.
He did that Jonah Hex recently. That was real nice.
Yeah, he's
the last
done
issue of Jonah Hex.
He did a great run on the Spirit a number of years
back.
The
Spirit, yeah.
That's right, for DC. Did I think
really
he did
good.
11 issues, and they're fantastic. You can get them in a trade.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on. We have the crazy Canadian, Dave Sim.
That's busy.
Personally, he's one of my favorite artists and designers. And yeah, you're right. This particular image and a lot of his stuff is incredibly busy.
Sorry. Hey, musical interlude. Yeah, did Gerhard work a lot on this, or is that just him?
Yeah, no, he worked with Gerhard, who was a background artist. So in this image right here, the buildings in the very background, Gerhard did, but then the characters, the design, the pacing, and all those bubbles and all the dialogue is all Dave Sim. Now, he's known for being quite a radical and experimentalist with page designs, because he, just like Chris Ware, he'll turn, books sideways and upside down for you to have to read them. But also, in something that's huge, is dialogue, and in and out of word balloons, explosions, sound effects, things like that. He makes them very organic and real. And this is a really good example as the villains of the piece are called Sirenists. They can communicate telepathically. So everything you're seeing that says kill him and all these little triangles or diamond shapes are they're communicating with their mind there, and it's kind of like a hive colony. So this is all of the Sirenists kind of talking, and then in the background you have this group of people hanging out the building saying Hail Cerberus. They're kind of on his side, and this is just a really fun piece. I've always liked it, but as anyone that's ever listened to the show knows, I'm a huge Dave Sim fan, and it was really difficult for me to find just one piece. And this isn't even close to my favorite piece by him, but I thought it was a fairly good example of everything.
Everything in Cerberus I always liked. I liked how the character was designed and drawn. I liked when Dave Sim did the strip by himself. When Gerhard joined him, it just got far better. But there were some issues where, there's one where he was going through levels. There was like a voiceover where Cerberus is basically just going through some kind of plane of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about his magic training, what level he got to, and he was saying, I don't know, fifth level or something like that. And that's an issue I kept. I gave all my single issues to Dallas at one point.
There were spheres that he was moving up.
Yeah, it was
8 or 9 of them.
I thought that was clever. And just how he set up the panels and how he laid the whole thing out, it was very artistic. Yet, whenever we talk about this on the show, and I look up pages for Cerberus, it's the most mundane pages I've ever seen.
Because a lot of it, it's hard to take it out of context. If you're reading
it,
it makes much more sense and it's more fun.
But he was always clever. Just sometimes the covers were pretty Spartan. It was just Cerberus and a shape behind him. But it always fit the story. He was always a storyteller first and foremost, but he always had a strong sense of design in everything he did. And that was one of the aspects of it that I always liked. Even his, what was his strip, Glamour Puss, that book, you had an issue.
Yes.
I was really surprised that he's drawn in a different style. He seems to me like he's taken a lot of static images from other areas. but just how he composes each section of page, it's very designerly.
Good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, he's fantastic. And if you want to see a master craftsman, one of the modern masters, I would say, check out Dave Sim. His most famous work, of course, is Cerebus. He did, as Don mentioned, Glamour Puss. He was also working on a book, and I honestly don't know if it's been released yet. He was collecting in the back of Glamour Puss called The Death of Alex Raymond.
Oh,
that was
yeah,
really
I've seen
good
some
too.
Of those. Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't know about he had a sketchy, you know, something happened.
The
to
car
him.
Accident.
Alex Raymond?
Yeah, apparently some there's some weirdness.
Yeah,
really?
I'll let you buy
I didn't
those
know it
issues.
Either.
I have, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right, moving along.
Yes.
Next, we've got one of the absolute giants of the comic book medium, or comic strip medium, I guess I should say, George Harriman, who's most famous for Crazy Cat, or Crazy Enigmats, and it was a comic strip, the comic strip, back in, I think it started in the late teens, like 1918, something like that, and it went all the way through the early 40s, I think. Harriman worked on it for, you know, a good 20, 30 years. And just like a couple of his peers at the time, he was one of the giants in the comic strip industry because he was really pushing the medium, and he was creating the language. He was helping to create the language of comic strips and comic books.
Yeah.
And the image that I have right here, this was a Sunday page, and it may have originally been produced in color. I don't remember this one. But you can just see, I mean, some of the stuff that's going on now. This one's from the 20s, I'm pretty sure. Stuff that, you know, the panel layouts and the pacing and the way it's moving and how everything is tilting, that was pretty awesome. I mean, there were only one or two other artists at the time that were even doing these kind of experimentations in comic strips. And George Harriman's kind of, his character and himself, they're not as famous as some of the other creations that came out at the time, but in the industry, you know, in the comic strip industry, he's, you know, one of the huge legends.
Everybody always remembers Crazy Cat because the backgrounds would change.
Right.
Like if it was one sequence of like four panels, it had the same main characters, but the background was always different. It was always, you know, like, I don't know where he lived exactly. Somewhere in the desert somewhere. But they
Arizona, I think.
Was it Arizona?
Yeah.
It was somewhere. I can't remember.
Coconino or something like that was called.
But they were talking about him. I guess some historian was going through there, a couple of guys, and they went. He was already gone. But they went, his family was there. And they said that they were trying to, you know, get the artwork to do this compilation. And I thought, oh, yeah, it's all out, and there's a shed outside the house. And they had the artwork there. I said, we got it. And these guys were like, what? And they walked out there, and he said, one thing about this desert, it's always dry. You know, I mean, you can keep the stuff outside, and it'll keep. But it's something like, I don't know, every so often, or maybe every 40 years or something, there's a big rainstorm and flood. And all the artwork was there. But it had been wet. It was all one big giant mound.
Oh,
and,
horrible.
You know, every time I hear this story, everybody's like, you know, gnashing teeth and, you know. But he, when he died, I think it was Hearst in the newspaper. That was his favorite strip. I don't think Crazy Cat was ever a big, I don't think it was a big strip like some of the others, like a big moneymaker. I think it's just that people liked it.
Yeah,
it was kind of like jazz.
Everybody knew what it was, though.
Yeah, it was kind of like jazz. But when George Harriman died, the publisher of the paper said that strip was too special for anybody else to attempt. So he just retired it, and it was kind of a forgotten strip. I'd see it in old history books, like Reader's Digest had a history of the United States, and they had, you know, Yellow Kid and Crazy Cat and Mutt and Jeff and all that. And sometime in the early, guessing it was the mid-70s, my brother got a copy. And it was a collection of Crazy Cat. And they told the whole story of George Harriman, had color strips in it. It was opened by the poet E.E. Cummings, who was a real oddball poet. But one thing about Crazy Cat, besides just the fantastic page layouts and design, and this one that Dallas chose is a good one, but kind of mundane compared to some of the other ones he came up with. And they were wild and free, but it was his dialogue, how those characters talked. They had, I'm guessing, like an American street talk.
Yeah,
you know?
Like a dialect.
Yeah, it was a dialect, and that's absolutely right. And I remember one, the mouse, what was his name, Ignatz?
Ignatz.
Mm-hmm.
He had a telescope, and he got a crazy cat looking through it, and he's telling her what she's looking at, and she'd say, "How obscure." But it wasn't spelled properly. You know, I remember my cousin, I'm guessing he was in elementary school, and when we were looking at the strip, he kept repeating what she was saying and laughing because it was just so outrageous. You could tell what she's saying, but the dialogue was just fantastic. There's nobody like him.
Yeah.
Also, he was a huge influence on L.Z. Seeger, the guy that created Popeye.
Oh, nice.
You know?
I remember in the 60s seeing a TV or cartoons of Crazy Cat, and it was the weirdest thing that I'd ever seen, yeah.
And the voiceover doesn't really match up with the animation. It's kind of, it goes with it, but it's like this woman for Crazy. I never knew Crazy Cat was a female in this, when I read the strip. But the mouse would hit her with a brick, and she, "Oh, little angel." You kind of mumble it. And I thought,
It was weird.
It had a charm to it.
Yeah, it says here where he was from New Orleans. And he says he came from a line of French-speaking Louisiana Creole mulatto. So he was a person of color. He was an African American. I didn't realize that until like a few years ago, and I was like, "Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I guess then he moved over to you said Arizona or whatever. He did the strip, but it's very interesting. And maybe that's where the dialect comes from the Creole or from the New Orleans.
I've always heard somebody said he heard he was a black person, but I've seen pictures. I see a white man, unless he's.
Yeah, he's got. He must have a mix or something in there. He's got black.
But it's probably the verbiage you're talking about. Probably something from Louisiana.
Sit down and you read some Crazy Cat, and it's specifically crazy when you see the way she speaks.
Yeah, I have to say, one time we were driving from Texas back here to Florida, and we stopped in Lafayette. Is it Lafayette or Baton Rouge? We stopped at a Popeye's Fried Chicken, and there's a woman now taking orders. And I had no idea what she was saying. And she was sitting taking an order, and I guess my wife had said what she wanted. And then she goes, "I don't want." And my wife's looking at it, and she says it three times, just looking plainly. And I realized she was asking side order. And this is what's stupid. I'm at the counter telling my wife what she's saying. And then she, you know, after the side order, you're supposed to tell her, I don't know, whatever else it was. There's three things. And I had to get used to the rhythm of her voice to figure out what she was saying. And then my daughter went up to order, same thing. And I was standing there at the counter telling my daughter what she's saying. The woman was speaking English, I mean, you know, but...
It was just that accent.
Yeah, it was such a unique thing that you couldn't get past it. And my wife and daughter couldn't understand. And then she asked me, and I don't know what she's talking directly to me. I was doing what my wife and daughter was doing. And I had to make myself think what she's saying and order it. And then the next woman, the manager, got the food out, and she was such a bright person, you know, and she was saying something like, you know, "Thanks for coming, and I hope you enjoy your order." But it was just like, it was like the teachers in Charlie Brown on those animated series, except that it was this melodic thing, where I'm thinking they're speaking the only language I can speak in my life, and I still have no idea what they're saying. So, yeah, Crazy Cat is Creole.
George Harriman did a lot of work before Crazy Cat, too, and he created a lot of cartoon characters, but his life's work, his most famous work is Crazy Cat. Some of the books are called Crazy Enigmats that are collected, if you can find those.
And they're well worth getting, too.
Yes. How are we doing for time? Should we take a break?
Take a break.
We're going to take another music break, and then we'll be back with the rest.
And that was Samaria once again. It's the same song we played earlier, but this time it was the acoustic version, which, or unplugged version, I should say, which is quite nice. Again, if you're anywhere near Manila, go see these guys. If they're not playing anywhere, hire these guys. I like them.
The next music break, they're going to do that song by a cappella.
They could.
Barbershop Quintet.
Next up, we have Howard Chaykin. My first exposure to Chaykin was his work on Star Wars. He did when the Star Wars film was first adapted, Marvel had the rights to it back in 77, and they did a comic book adaptation of the original Star Wars movie, and Howard Chaykin drew it. So years later, back when I was a kid, probably somewhere in the late 80s, They reproduced it in like an oversized edition.
A treasury
edition, and I had that. I remember picking it up. My mom got it for me. It was like $1.25 or something.
I had two of those.
Yeah, the Empire Strikes Back one was by Al Williams.
Yeah.
Which, he's not in here, but he's an incredible artist.
Greatness.
So Howard Chaykin.
Yeah, one of the best designers, yeah. That page there, pure design right there, you know.
Well, the first time I saw Howard Chaykin, this is something Al and I get in arguments about.
One of the many things.
Yeah. When he first started was...
You win always, though, because you threatened me with bodily harm.
Yeah, that's me. When he first started, it was with DC, the Burroughs work, and he was doing his own strip called Iron Wolf. It was a different style than what people attest to him now, but it's something I really enjoyed, and he also did a... Sword and Sorcery for DC, which is a Fafnir and a Gray Mouser strips. I really liked him then, which that's your favorite work. But later he started, I think he did a series of graphic novels. I don't know what the company was called, but it was, I think it was Byron Priest.
Mm-hmm.
But it was those science fiction, My Star is My Destiny. And he was also doing Cody Starbuck.
I like Cody Starbuck. Honestly.
But that's where the style was starting to change to the Howard Chaykin style everybody knew. I bought one of those graphic novels. I don't think I have any longer, but I really liked the artwork and how he laid pages out and how he drew the characters. But at the time of my life, it just wasn't interesting enough to me to read them. And I don't know, maybe I was just too young. But then I saw him at a convention in 82. And he would do covers for Epic Illustrated, that type of work. But he said that's about as far as he got to the comics industry. And then all of a sudden, First Comics started publishing American Flag, which is still my favorite Howard Chaykin work. He wrote it, drew it, created the whole strip. The lettering was done by Ken Brusniak, who contributed to the composition of all this stuff just as much. It really went with what Howard Chaykin's graphic design was. But it was neat. He had basically had everything. He had a whole system of money. It was a whole future thing. Everybody lived in shopping malls in the future. Everything was ruled by television. He even had his own designer drugs in it. But every page was a unique layout, along with telling the story. He never stopped. For DC, after he did American Flag, he did, I think it's 3 issues of The Shadow. Where he added to The Shadow, where I guess there's like 2 or 3 different shadows in the past. There's Lamont Cranston or somebody else, and one of these old guys was doing kind of like children's birthday parties, you know, shopping mall appearances. They kind of turned it a joke, and then they had a new guy. Well, I think it was a new guy, but I think it was one of the original guys that found Shangri-La. And he showed up in the modern age with his 2 sons, which were about the same age he was. Except they were half Chinese. Oh, he also did a 3 prestige format books of Black Hawk for DC. It has the infamous blowjob scene.
No, I don't think Will Eisner was too happy with that.
And he did a bunch. He did all kinds of strips for, I think, Epic. He did Midnight Men, 3 issues of that. And then he did
tons of work.
Power and Glory.
The infamous Black Kiss, which, Dallas, you were going to use a page from, but... Decided not to.
Oh, yeah. Looking for Google Images, I found a page out of that. I'm like, this is a little too hardcore for us.
For us, yeah.
I think it was Vortex Comics that did that one. And I bought the first issue. It came in a sealed plastic bag, which at the time you never saw. It was a black and white book. It was on really slick paper, and it was 8 pages. And it cost more than a regular comic book. And I loved Howard Chaykin, so I bought it. And it was only 8 pages, and I read it, and he was really letting loose. He likes to draw sexy things. And this was, I understood why they put it in the sealed plastic bag. Well, at the time, I was newly married. I just didn't have that much disposable income. And I'm thinking, God, it's like I'm paying all this money for a pamphlet. And I never saw any other issues. I was surprised. I guess he told a full story in it. And I guess you can buy the trade now, Black Kiss. He was doing a second Black Kiss, and I heard him in an interview, and he said that he was really happy with the way the story turned out, but I guess the readership dwindled as it went on. Well, I only saw the first issue. The store I went to didn't, any store I went to didn't carry any of them. But I liked the artwork. It was good, and it was something he really loved and was close to. But it was sealed for a reason. I've never seen the trades either.
One thing I really like about this piece that we have as an example, the one that Don picked out, is the top half's cool because the background uses these kind of, I guess, light sensual colors, which kind of goes along with the theme, or at least the title there. You got some pinks and purples. The bottom's got these really bright primary colored symbols, you know, like the men's bathroom, the dollar sign, the no smoking sign, and all that. And that's just a neat piece of iconography down there because those are immediately. You know exactly what they are the minute you see them, and it's kind of neat to have them along the bottom.
He also on the American flag stuff, he had a text, I'm guessing a textured paper duotone, because sometimes the pants and some of the ladies' hair, it was some type of odd shading I never seen anybody else use. And it's absolutely my favorite Howard Chaykin work, and I guess they've put it out in trades now. And this came out in 1983 on up, but he also did everything in, I think, 4-issue arcs. It was a continuing series. But I was shocked at the time that he was doing that much work at that high of a level continuously. And I guess after about 3 years, I kind of stopped reading it because it looked like he wasn't drawing it quite so much anymore. Come to find out he had a lot of assistants doing it and stuff.
Mike Rosberg.
Well, at one point, I guess he was getting more involved in it again, and the issues were up higher. This is in 87. And I bought the first issue, and yeah, Mike Wolfsburg was the main artist on it, but there was other people. I like Mike Wolfsburg a lot, but yeah, I liked it when Howard Chaykin was in control of everything himself. It wasn't quite so good when other people were writing and drawing
All right, so moving along. So that's Chaykin. He's done a ton of stuff, most notably his American flag and the billions of other books he's done. Next up we have,
Who is that
I don't know about this guy.
guy?
Jack Kirby.
He overdraws a little bit too much, but.
We've got the king. And I love this picture. This is a great example. Who supplied this one?
You did.
I did? Oh.
Unless you did.
No. Oh no, I did find this one. It's the Black Panther. And this image, although it doesn't, everybody knows Jack Kirby. He's basically the father of superhero comic books. He defined the generation back in the early 60s with Marvel Comics. This picture isn't such a good example of this sequential art, which you can find many other pages that do show good examples, but just this page, as far as being dynamic, big characters, big ideas. I mean, it almost looks three-dimensional with the character in the foreground. Just this image is so iconic, you know, it's awesome.
Oh yeah,
And I mean, everybody,
definitely.
what can I don't know what can be said
That's
about Kirby.
power, that's what he was all about, powerful, imagery, and he is a master of it.
Well, on this one here, this is the Black Panther series, which I bought these when they came out,
Is
but
this from the 70s?
yeah,
It looks
77.
later, but okay.
76, 77.
Yeah, because it looks like his DC work.
No, it was Marvel.
It's Marvel.
No, I know that, but I mean
No.
that style, like it reminds me of the New Gods
Yeah, it's really.
era, which is just after that, right? Is New
Yeah.
Gods his early 70s?
Yep.
Yeah, 71. 70, 71. But no, the Black Panther, he always had a double page spread, and every one of them was unique. It was just full of stuff. I bought these, and every time I get them, I was excited because I love Jack Kirby. I love the whole cosmic stuff, and every time I get them, I didn't enjoy reading the stories as much. I look back at them now, they're fantastic. And I did love the two-page spread. You'd open it up, and it was just, He could put a lot of stuff on a page and never get you lost. And
Yep.
even if they were just wild and far out, it was just always fun.
No, that's, I
Absolutely.
mean, you know, no, I mean, what more can you say? He was the king of comics.
Yeah,
You know, I mean,
enough said.
yeah, exactly. Stan.
I mean, Jack Kirby, for anyone who doesn't know Jack Kirby, just look at his early work in Marvel and the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, the
Sure,
X-Men, pretty much Thor, definitely the Mighty Thor. And then, like we mentioned, his DC stuff, which included the New Gods and Omega
Well, I mean, he
Man,
designed all the
Commandy.
costumes, all the characters. I mean,
Yeah.
in a lot of ways, besides the design on the page, is the design of the Marvel Age. You know, basically, you know, I mean, not all
You're
the
right.
characters, but most of them. You know, a lot of them anyway. Yeah, definitely, that's where he excels at. No doubt about that.
All right, so moving along. Next, we have my personal favorite, J.H. Williams III. Most prominently known for his work on Promethea, which Don and I have talked ad nauseum about. And more recently, he did a stint in Detective Comics and then a longer stint on Batwoman. And so this example I took out of one of his early Batwoman issues, I think. Just a huge double-page spread that just kind of exemplifies his style of telling a story in a comic book. Very dynamic, but once again, and just like you guys said about Kirby, you don't get lost in the pictures. This one's kind of usually it's a story that he's kind of conveying. This just happens to be one single action scene, and it's just kind of stressed across this big dynamic shot of Batwoman on top and all these lightning bolts and everybody that she happens to be fighting, and then in the very background, almost just kind of a grayscale, you see where they're fighting at. And it's just a huge dynamic pick, and it works in a couple different ways. It works like a lot of his art, especially on Batwoman, works, and that's as just this one single, you know, shot. You could have this as a nice piece of fine art up on your wall. But in the context of the issue, if you're reading the comic, this makes complete sense. It fits in with the story, it fits in with the art and the sensibilities and the way he's expressing every other page, too.
What's neat about this page right here, and he did this all the time, is behind the Batwoman figure, you know, she's got a gray background, but he's got panel borders and it's lightning bolts, it's all red, and it has action going on in there. So it's like telling you a time sequence, even though it's one static image. He did little tricks like that all the time, playing with the form. A lot of times when people try to attempt these things, it's like you don't know what's going on, you get lost, it's easy to do. When he does it, it's effortless, and you're like, it's just, you could take every page out of this and frame it and hang it up. But at the same time, it's sequential, it does tell a story. And he can jump from style to style, which is, not many people do it, and there's only a few people who can do it as well as he does, because every style he works with seems like that's the sole style he spent his entire life working on.
Yeah, even some of his earlier stuff you see, not his very early work, but some of his earlier work you see very experimental stuff, and that helps that some of his contemporaries he was working with were guys like Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti, who were fairly experimental themselves in their pacing and their panel layouts and displays. And I think it really strengthened his style and his avant-garde sensibilities when he started working with Alan Moore, who had such a distinct vision for Promethea. And when J.H. Williams III was drawing Promethea, not only was he working with Alan Moore, but he was also throwing in his own artistic styles. And I mean, between the two of those guys, their visions, I mean, that book just looks beautiful. I couldn't tell you another comic book that looks more beautiful than that, visually at least.
It's a fantastic book. The story and the art match each other, and it finishes,
yeah,
which is rare.
This is rare in a good comic. Yeah.
Yeah, for something on that level to actually finish with the same creative team and the same level of, you know, tech quality.
So that's J.H. Williams III. I mean, look for some of his. He's not. I don't think he's doing Batwoman anymore, but up until a year or two ago, he was. And just look at his run of Batwoman is incredible. All right. So next up, we've got Jim Steranko. Now, I kind of cheated and I used two separate pages here because I really couldn't choose which one I liked more. Now, I'm sure the two of you guys could find a billion other pages you like more than these two, but I thought these
were... That's the one where he kind of got in trouble
A little racy, the one on the right. Oh, yeah, at the time.
Is the last panel the gun in the holster?
Yeah.
Yeah, they thought that was a little bit too too suggestive, like Nick sealed the deal or something.
Well, and there
like
you go. That. He was doing some really interesting, fun stuff in comics, including
he was a graphic designer before comics.
Yep. Yeah, he was. And it shows. It definitely shows. And even his pacing, even on the image, the page on the right, it's the graphic design is good, but look at the pacing and the storytelling in it. I mean, it's perfect. You know exactly what's happening and when it's happening.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's fun. I mean, it's very James Bondish. That's obviously Nick Fury. I don't know the girl because I've never read these old Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. books. But it's
it's no, he was one of the few guys that came in, the new guys that came in the comics in the 60s, and he was one of the few that actually got artist writer credit because he was such a big, you know, deal when he came into Marvel. He was such a you know, phenomenon that you know, he got to be like a real influential artist, and he only did what, like 30 or 35 comic books. That's it.
Yeah, the body of work was fairly small, but he's
but impressive.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite part about it was in Marvel Comics Untold story. They said when he went to the office's portfolio, Flo Steinberg said, well, they don't see anybody from the outside. And his comment was, he'll want to see me. And so she ended up taking his portfolio to Stan Lee. And then she came back and says, Stan does want to see you. She was kind of bewildered. But I thought, man, how awesome would that be? You will want to see me.
Steranko says he'll want to see him.
He's a pretty interesting guy. Besides being a designer, he was also an illusionist, you know, a stage magician.
Well, he was an escape artist, too.
Yeah, which that's why Jack Kirby based Mr. Miracle off of.
Mr. Miracle, yeah.
But I think he was the first writer-artist at Marvel.
Yeah, he was, man.
And the thing about him, my friend Britt loves Steranko. I've seen the work through him. And a lot of times I see the pages in magazines or book collections. And some of those S.H.I.E.L.D. Things are just captivating. Like the pages Dallas has here, there's another one where Hydra, they're on some type of
big building?
Well, it's excuse me. It's some type of transport, and they're all coming out of these portholes and screaming. Stuff like that is just staggering. But when I've tried to read the stories, I don't enjoy them quite so much. I've read his Captain America issues he did, which, again, I'd see examples of those all the time. Incredible. But reading them, no. It just doesn't catch me as much. I like his covers. I like the ideas. I like some of the sequences. But I don't find I enjoy reading his stories quite so much.
Maybe they were of their time.
Could be. He did, in Heavy Metal, it's when, there was a movie Sean Connery's in called Outland, you know, about those space miners that were blowing up. And in Heavy Metal magazine, they serialized it, and Jim Steranko did the adaptation. And I was kind of surprised because it didn't look like the Nick Fury style. It was kind of rough. But when I started reading it, it just sucked me right in. You know, he had the whole narrative of the movie, and I'd already seen the movie. But yet, I enjoyed reading the serialization in the comic just as much. He's got the tropes down to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the bulk, you can find the bulk of Steranko's work in a bunch of collected editions. It was mostly in the late 60s as far as Marvel Comics went. He did some Nick Fury stuff, some Captain America. He did a couple issues of the Uncanny X-Men. I want to say issues 50, 51, and 52,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, a few, yeah. A
couple of them.
And he illustrated books about Chandler, right? That Private Eye.
He did like a little graphic novel, a little digest side. I think it was called Chandler. It was really good. I think they just reprinted it in a different, maybe a graphic, more of a graphic novel. But yeah, oh yeah, definitely. One of the greats, definitely.
Up next, we have a French artist named Mobius. Also, his real name is Jean Girard, but he's always been known by his pen name Mobius when he does fantastic or science fiction style artwork. And he was big in the 70s and 80s, I believe. Right, Don?
Yeah.
I didn't see his stuff so much later
also,
than that.
But...
Yeah, that's right. He was a Western artist. I was surprised to find out that in France, they love American Westerns. And I guess one of his instructors was a Western strip artist called JJ. I think it's how you pronounce it. It was JEJE. But Mobius started Lieutenant Blueberry with, I can't remember his name, Chevalier. And he was famous for that. And then at one point, some friends started doing all these experimental stories, science fiction type work. And he was wanting to do it as well, but he didn't want to alienate his audience because he figured they wouldn't want to see this wild stuff. He always signed his work Gir, G-I-R. So that's where he came up with the pen name of Mobius and started doing the Detour and all these type of stories.
Which was drastically different as far as his style,
Yeah.
where like the Blueberry stuff was fairly detailed, a little more realistic, and a lot of his Mobius stuff was very fantastic, but also very minimalistic.
Well, it didn't start out that way. The Detour was extremely detailed, more detailed than the Western stuff, but it was a different style. Had a lot of philosophy, a lot of contrary logic, and but every issue, every story was different. It was a different style. He was just letting loose and playing. And then in a certain amount of time, Mobius got to be far more popular than, Gerard, which is the joke. And then after he started doing the Mobius stories, the Blueberry work started changing as well. It was still the Western type art, but you could see a shift in the art style. When I first started seeing his work, I honestly didn't understand what the big deal was about him because everybody just held him such high esteem. Arzak was the one. I kept seeing that trade everywhere, and every time
From Metal Hurlant, I think it
Metal
started
Hurlant,
in,
yeah.
which is really popular.
Well, he was the founder of Metal Hurlant. And but the Arzak book, every time they say Arzak, everybody would stop for a minute, like, trying to catch their breath. And I'd see parts of the Airtight Garage serialized in heavy metal, but it didn't make any sense. It was like a drummer playing 1/4/4 beat with one hand and a 16th beat with the other hand, and it was just a mismatch to me. I liked some of the drawings. I thought it was kind of fun, but it never made sense. I couldn't figure it out. And it was in 1981, Heavy Metal put out a Mobius special. It was a little trade, and I liked a couple of drawings, and I'll pick it up. And it had the first section of the Inkle in it, the first chapter. And I just found that staggering. After that, I was a huge Mobius fan. It was just some of the best work I ever read. And I liked all the other short stories and stuff he did in it. I enjoyed how he went from style to style. And I started enjoying what he said, and I was actively seeking out his work. This panel we got here, it's just a single drawing. It's not really a sequential strip, but at the same time, it's telling the whole story because it's like some space transport. There's a giant red craft opened up, and there's a single person running to it, running late. And it's like he conveys so much work with just a simple little thing, even though the drawing's really complex. He could tell a story, but his work was just completely different from everybody else, and especially at the time in the early 80s. Frank Miller, Steve Laiolola, Walt Simonson all had a massive Mobius influence to their work.
And you can see that in some of their stuff, like, well, Miller's Ronin
Yeah.
definitely had a movie's influence.
No doubt about it, man. Yeah, definitely, like, his style changed completely throughout the years, evolved or whatever, yeah.
So he's definitely one of the greats. Yeah, some of his more popular stuff, it's all collected, but like Don mentioned, the Inkle, Arzak is one of his early huge works. A lot of his stuff in Metal Hurlant has been collected in different Metal Hurlant and Heavy Metal collections, so you can find that
Well,
stuff.
the problem is now it's hard to get his work here in English in the
At
United
least
States.
cheap, yeah.
No, it's not that. It's there was a big petition on Facebook about that. I didn't understand why after Epic Comics under Marvel, they brought all the work over here in English, and it was fantastic. And then once that license dropped out, Mobius disappeared from the United States. I'd see once in a while, I think Dark Horse is putting out these really tiny Mobius books in black and white, which were disappointing. But they said And I saw new material, which is aggravating me. So why don't they, I think Caliber did a series too. Why aren't they putting these out anymore? Well, there was a big petition for it because you can get them in other languages around the world, but you can't get it here in the United States in English. And the petition just kept growing and growing. More people were joining that group. And finally, somebody notified Mobius's widow. And then she sent a note saying she is aware of the situation in the United States. She knows there's an audience for it. They just haven't found the group. I guess they don't want everything done in piecemeal. Like, you know, Marvel publishes one book, you know, Excalibur publishes another one. And they're looking for a, I guess they're wanting a regular publisher, not a comic publisher, because they want the whole, you know, it put out.
The whole catalog.
And I thought, well, that's, and then, you know, basically the person who put the group together said that's all he wanted was an answer. So you know somebody's working on it, so they closed the group. But Mobius work you can get, but it's kind of few and far between right now. But there's a vast amount. And if you speak French, then buy all of it and you're a lucky person.
One thing that was published here in the States by Mobius was a book back in the 80s, written by Stan Lee. It was a Silver Surfer book.
Yeah.
So you can find that. All right, moving on. Next up, we have, and we've mentioned him a few times already in this episode, Neil Adams. Next to Kirby, he's one of the most influential visual comic artists in the superhero medium. Neil Adams got his start in superhero comics in the late 60s with, what, Batman, maybe, around that time?
He started working in DC, but he
Yeah.
got famous for Batman. He started working for DC. He was doing a lot of
He started for Archie.
started for Archie, yeah, but he started doing a lot of covers and stuff like that, and then the Batman clicked, and then he went on to do X-Men back in the 60s.
Right, and
I think
this
he did Brave and the Bold first.
Yeah, you're right, Brave and the Bold, yeah.
And
And then
then
he went to
afterwards
Batman.
he did the Green Lantern, Green Arrow stuff. Now this I think Page from X-Men is a prime example of what he was famous for, is taking the sensibilities of comic books at the time and creating a huge dynamic flair using a graphic novel or a graphic design eye. I mean, you look at this and look how beautiful this is laid out, and look how well he gets his point across as to what's happening here. I mean, just the composition, the angle that he has the character Beast falling from the building as he gets closer to the reader and to the bottom of the page. The great thing is, it's not really that important whether or not you look at that bottom left image or the upper right image first. You know that it doesn't really matter which one of those comes first, which one comes last. The four main pictures in the center are telling the sequential story, and that's kind of what you need to know.
Yeah,
Done really well,
no.
and this is what he was famous for. And also, and not even too much in this particular page here, but a lot of his images, his characters are very detailed and larger than life, and popping out of the panel borders, jumping into other borders as well. And he was kind of well known for that as well.
Yeah, he kind of combined illustration and Jack Kirby a little bit,
Yes, yes.
yeah,
Yeah,
to for a new audience.
but when I see his work, I don't ever think of Jack Kirby, but you're right, he did have a sensibility to it. Actually, Neil Adams would have been the last person that I would have put for design, because when I think of him, I think of heavy illustration. But I remember when Dallas was lending me the X-Men work he did in the 70s, I was shocked how much Alan Davis took from it. When I was
Yeah.
saying that, was the panel layouts. Like, this is a perfect example. And Alan Davis is his own person. He's one of my favorites. But and Alan Davis has always said huge Neil Adams influence. I've always thought of him, how Alan Davis draws faces. He gets some of it from Neil Adams. But Alan Davis is always unique at how he puts the pages and panels together. He's always jagging them. He puts them sideways. And when I started seeing that old X-Men work, I said, well, that's probably a big influence on it. He was very graphic design, but you just can't get past his illustration.
Yeah, that's the thing, yeah.
Okay. Well, along with so he's best known for, we'll name some of his works, along with one or two other artists of the late 60s or 70s, he basically created the pretty much modern incarnation of Batman. He did an extremely good and popular run in the Avengers, including the Kree-Skrull War.
With Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, with Harlan Ellison. And he did the definitive pre-giant size X-Men story, or run, rather.
And definitely.
I mean, among a lot of other stuff, but those are some of his more famous pieces. And he also he formed a comic line called Continuity Comics,
Yeah.
and he did a few different comics in there too. But I'm not that familiar with him.
It's a massive amount of work, and he still does work.
He's still working his butt off to this day.
Yeah, so you can just type in his name, and you'll find all kinds of books to read.
Up next, all right, we have P. Craig Russell. Don?
Okay, P. Craig Russell, I think most people remember him. He started out, I think the first work that people know was Killraven, War of the Worlds from Marvel Comics. And it was basically an old H.G. Wells, ad, but basically the Martians were turning people into gladiators. He had more of a Neil Adams Marvel Comics kind of style at the time, but he quickly changed it. Whenever I think of P. Craig Russell, I think of tribal and also think of ballet. His characters are always very elegant. I mean, not always ballet types, but there was a dance aspect to it. But his design elements were unique. He reminds me of old storybooks. Every page was just something. He had a real heavy Musha influence later on. And his later work, he started treating them all as operas. He started converting what was it? The Magic Flute, the Ring of the Nebulon, adapting these old operas to it. But everything he was signing as opera, 19, opera 57. Absolutely one of my favorites. Just go ahead.
Oh, you just mentioned, his artwork is quite elegant. The first time I saw him, and pretty much the only art that I know from P. Craig Russell is his short run on The Sandman. He did a few issues here and there, and it was always beautiful looking. The style, the smoothness of line that he uses is fantastic. And this example, the visual one that we have here, you see why he's a master storyteller. I mean, from the first to the last panel, you really don't need any words to it. It tells the story by itself just on the power of the images and the way they're set in motion and in sequence. It's fantastic. I definitely like him. I've always liked him. I don't know a lot of his work.
Well, like I said, he did the Killraven work, and then he did all kinds of, I don't know, I guess I want to call them one-off experimental pieces for like Stargreach magazine. No, I'd always see short stories here and there in some art type magazines and comics. He started it. My favorite work he did was he was adapting with Roy Thomas the Elric of Melniboné, the Michael Moorcock work. He did Elric the Dreaming City as a graphic novel, and in Epic Illustrated he did another Elric story. I can't remember the name of it now, but they were fantastic. And then with Pacific Comics, he did six issues again with Roy Thomas and Michael T. Gilbert. I penciled them, and actually I think Russell broke them down. Michael T. Gilbert penciled them in, and then Craig Russell inked it over it. It was kind of unique, and he went from there. You can buy them now. There was a series of Oscar Wilde storybooks. He illustrated the Lonely Giant, or the Selfish Giant. Again, he just never stops. I know he's done the Jungle Book works, and some of it was with Gil Kane as well as himself. He's got a vast majority of work. He just pops up everywhere. He also finished Elric for Topps. He did another adaptation. But the work goes from really cartoony, which I like, to a little more realistic. And in Megacon, I bought a collection of his short stories. I remember in Epic Illustrated, he had a story about a cherubim. And some of those, it was pencil drawings that looked kind of like real, faces and stuff. And then it went to and the same thing was a black and white piece, silent. But it went to the real cartoony type work. And I guess he's teaching at Kent State, and he drew that story as an example for the students on how to tell a sequential story with no words.
Thanks.
But you look him up, there's all kinds of volumes of all kinds of work he's done.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Elric because, just as an aside, Dave Sim kind of ruined Elric for me. Dave Sim, the Cerebus Comics, He was a satirist. Sim was, and he had a character named Elrond of Melvinbone, kind of making fun of Elric. And so
Yeah.
whenever I think of Elric, I remember Elrond.
And he talked like Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
And Wendy Penny was really surprised, the woman that did ElfQuest, because she was a huge Michael Moorcock fan. Come to find out, Dave Sim had never read any of the books. The only thing he got was in the old Conan the Barbarian comic book from Marvel that Roy Thomas wrote, Barry Smith was drawing, and they did two issues where Conan and Elric meet. And Dave Sim did all of his work based off those two issues. And she said she was kind of aghast. Says, "Well, you got Elric down, even though it was cartoony."
Nailed it.
I kind of nailed it. Those were fun. But the Elric stuff is really good, even though he tries to marry his cousin, and it's just weird. But
On that note, we're moving along. Next up, is this the last one? No, we've got a couple more, I think. So next up, we have the absolute giant, Will Eisner. He's basically, Will Eisner is known as the grandfather of sequential art. I mean, his persona and his work is married with comic books and the graphic novel. So if you're a lover of comic books and a lover of the medium itself, there's no doubt that you know of him and you've seen his work. His early, very seminal work was on a comic strip called The Spirit, and it was an 8-page insert in newspapers back in the 30s. Into the 40s, I believe. And this stuff was amazing because he was basically rewriting the way you could tell a story. And yeah, this isn't the best example. Don's squinting at it because this one's in black and white, but it shows what he was able to do. And oftentimes he's drawing images outside of the box, literally outside of the panel. He's incorporating the name of the comic and words and sound effects into the images. And his use, I wanted to show this example, which is black and white, because of his use of lights and dark tones and shading. And he was a master at using inks and shading to tell a story and to create an ambiance. This is obviously a very gothic story set in a 1930s kind of crime district. And it shows that the Spirit was a crime fighter, not too dissimilar from Batman. And a lot of Eisner's later stuff, which was equally experimental, were single graphic novel books, like The Building and A Contract with God, and The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and he had a ton of them.
his work on the Spirit, I found in the 70s he was doing work for Warren. They were republishing his old stuff. I had never heard of this work. Even though it was in the newspaper, it wasn't in all the newspapers. My parents, grandparents had never heard of it. They never ran anything in Texas. Al's dad knew of the Spirit from Cuba. A friend of mine had lived in Puerto Rico when he was a kid. And he read the Spirit in the newspaper there. They knew of it. I guess a lot of Caribbean Spanish-speaking countries, had it. His work on the Spirit to me is second to none. The other work is good, but it kind of pales in the comparison. But one thing, I've seen people do homages to the Spirit. One thing he's famous for is each time the strip came out, he spelled the Spirit with whatever was available. Fence posts, shadows, anything you could come up with was there. I've seen other people try to do that, and it's just always awkward and tedious. When he'd do it, one of my favorite pages is a piano player, and in the black and white keys, it spells out the Spirit while the guy's playing it. He wasn't afraid to play around and experiment with it, but it always moved the story away, ahead. I think the stories were only 7 or 8 pages each. So he didn't waste any time.
I mean, look at that first panel, the way the words are incorporated into the side of the building. And when the spirit enters through, what is that, a big window? Just the lights coming from the only light source basically is coming from outside, and it's shooting into the dark building. And near the bottom, underneath those three panels, you see the word later, and it's actually emanating from the smoke of the pipe. And I mean, just brilliant stuff. I mean, you can basically thank Eisner for writing the language of modern comic books.
One of my favorite stories he did was in the Spirit. was the guy that always wanted to fly, little guy. And the final page, basically the character had passed away. He was killed with crossfire between the spirit and these other guys. And it showed his ghost flying up out of the sky. But the way he laid that page out, it was very artistic. It was a simple page. But he knew how to use space and how not to use space.
Yep.
And it was actually pretty modern compared to the other comics of the time. Because people in the 80s were playing around with that type of format, and he was doing it back in the 40s.
You're absolutely right, and that's why one of the things I love about Eisner, especially his old work, is it still holds up to this day.
Yes.
All right, and guys, we have one last one.
Who's the grand finale?
The final artist is the great Winsor McCay.
Yeah, little Nemo.
Yeah, Winsor McCay, besides basically creating cartooning, animated segments, he created The Dreams of the Rarebit Fiend, which is a fairly popular comic strip back in the day. And then his most seminal and most popular work would be Little Nemo in Slumberland. It was, more than any other, it was incredibly difficult for me to choose just one page out of Little Nemo's catalog, because Winsor McCay was an experimenter and a graphic designer of the highest caliber. And I could have easily chosen nearly any single page out of Little Nemo, and it would just be completely representative of the comic book medium at its finest. And now this is incredibly early stuff. This is the teens, maybe into the 20s. I don't even remember anymore, but it was probably like 19, 15, 16, something like that.
Yeah.
And just look what he's doing and playing with the medium. I mean, you know, that top image just introducing the comic strip, and even the words are kind of intertwined with the image. And then you've got these four images of this segment of Little Nemo and his bed just rising up into the air. And then from there, all hell breaks loose, and everything's centered around this great, huge, round image.
I can see Chris Ware got some inspiration from Winsor McCay.
Yeah, and I would say probably even Chris Ware's eccentric color choices sometimes
could
come
like
from Winsor McCay's really great colorful palette that he uses.
You know, I was getting these Fantagraphics put out on four volumes of all the Little Nemo and Slumberland books. I loved them. And one thing, Little Nemo took up the entire newspaper page, all comic strips, and I had that. And at the top of the page, you'd have the, you know, what the newspaper was in the day. And I was surprised, this is running in the 1800s, at the very end. And as I was reading them, it went from the 1800s to the very early 1900s. Well, I was reading these in 1990. And I wasn't thinking about the time now, but I was thinking, what would it be like to read that at the turn of a century? You know, you go from the 1800s to 1900s. I was trying to figure out when I read those what people were thinking at the time. Because a lot of things started happening when the 1900s rolled around.
20th century was huge. It was like a fulcrum.
Exactly. And I think about that a lot now because we went from, you know, the 90s to the 2000s. The same thing happened to us. It wasn't fun. You know, 9/11 happened. The whole world went upside down.
The Y2K bug.
Yeah, which was a bust, but
still the idea behind it and just the scare that it generated.
The paranoia.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But I would say, I mean, anybody that's not familiar with McKay's work or not that familiar with Little Nemo or just enjoys great, colorful, beautiful-looking graphic design and artwork, just pick up some of the books or just even Google a few of these pages, and you can even just take a step back without even reading them. Just take a look at it. Look how beautiful the design work is. I mean, he embodies the greatest in design aesthetics, I think.
Those are big, oversized panels that you need to get them in like a large size.
That's right, and a lot of the books are oversized hardcovers they sell.
The oversized hardcovers they put out in the early 90s, they redid again. I don't know what company it was, but they're basically the size of a newspaper page. And I thought, what? They were $100 each. I would have liked to got one. One, I don't have the kind of money to buy, and I don't know where I'd put it if I did buy it. But there was an interview, I think, on Mr. Media, and the guy was talking about it. He said, this one guy collected all those pages, and he started realizing he's coming to a point in his life where he was going to be gone. And he says, those pages are starting, you know, it's newsprint, they're starting to turn to dust. And he says he's got to do something to preserve it. So they put out these books. I've seen them
That's
online.
awesome.
I would love to see one. I've seen some of Winsor McCay's work in the Cartoon Art Museum, or Museum of Cartoon Art, down in Alberta,
Gertie the
Montana.
Dinosaur, which is pretty much the
Well, that was
first
an
book.
animation, but he did, besides the comic strip, he did a lot of political cartoons. Fantagraphics put out a really nice book called Daydreams and Nightmares, and it had a lot of magazine illustration work. It had some science, I guess, kind of science fiction future type work. He had political cartoons, which were staggering. The animated cartoons he was doing, he did Gertie the Dinosaur, and he drew the entire thing. It was a dinosaur moving and walking. And people kept saying, "What are you going to do with something like this?" Well, he turned it into a vaudeville show. He got up in a suit and introduced the dinosaur, and then a screen behind him, the dinosaur came out. He gave orders to the dinosaur. The dinosaur ran to the horizon line, came back with a bone. And he had Gertie dance. He shared the stage with W.C. Fields. He was a pioneer, and a really hard-working pioneer.
Absolutely.
And when Little Nemo ended, that's when he started doing other work for Hearst at the newspaper. And I think eventually he brought it back as The Land of Wonderful Dreams, and there's still Little Nemo. But he also had a strip called Sammy Sneeze, which is out of print now, but there was a big collection of that work too. So, Winsor McCay, I would say a lot of people would argue, is the father of all cartoonists, but
Yeah, and that's
he's something.
So, like we said, you can find some of his reproduced work, including those oversized editions, online in some finer bookstores. And also, there was a collection of his earlier stuff, a lot of his political cartoons and the Dreams of the Ribbit Fiend. And they're collected in a book series called Winsor McCay Early Works. I think that's what it's
Okay.
called. And there's at least six or seven, if not more, volumes of that.
There's a lot of Winsor McCay books, and most of them are available.
And that concludes our lesson in the Masters of Graphic Design.
Our
And
epic show.
our epic show is probably one of the longest we've ever done.
One thing, there's a lot more masters than this. Al was getting on to me that I didn't include a few of them.
Walt Simonson.
Yeah, Walt Simonson. Alan Davis to me is another one, and
You mentioned
also.
Gil Kane earlier too. I thought about
Yeah,
that. Gil
and
Kane,
I
yeah.
thought of Steve Rude. I wanted to put Steve Rude in, but
We may have to do
you
another episode someday in the future to add more to this, but once again, these are just our opinions, and hopefully we shed some light on some artists that maybe some of you guys weren't aware of, and hopefully kind of expanded your horizons. And if you knew about all of them, hopefully this was just an entertaining 2 hours.
Right, and feel free on the Facebook page to post images of the certain page examples, and tell us why you like this person, if there's somebody that we've missed.
All right.
All right.
On that note, I want to thank everyone for listening to us. We really hope you enjoyed this overstuffed episode. Look forward, either next episode or in a couple episodes, we're going to do something similar, but this time, we're each going to choose our favorite individual comic book pages based on design or artwork or nostalgia or just wow factor.
Or
So,
availability.
or availability, I don't know. But that'll be entertaining and that'll be in the future. And either way, you can look for another episode in about a week. So, once again, thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. And have a happy holiday, safe, and take care of yourselves. And until next time,
read more comics.
To find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, or his blog, Destination Nightmare, as well as Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, check out the sidebar at our blog, bunchofdorks.com,
and click on the Cyclops.